Good day. Today is Monday, 3rd November 2025, and before I proceed with this video, let me remind you again to tick the like button if once you've heard and watched this video, or heard and watched that part of the video that you want to listen to and see, you've liked what you've heard and wish to indicate that fact. Well, today I will once again return to the topic of the conflict in Ukraine. That will be my main topic of discussion. But I will say before I do that the President of the United States, Donald Trump, has given a lengthy interview, 60 minutes to 60 minutes in the United States, the first such interview he's given for many years, in which he's tried to basically set out some of his ideas and purposes and give some answers to many of the questions that many people have been asking. On the topic of Venezuela and whether there will be an attack there, I noticed that he was extremely careful not to say one way or the other. He did say that in his opinion, he thought that President Maduro of Venezuela's days were ending, which, of course, could in theory be interpreted in all sorts of different ways. As to the issue of Venezuela, I will make the same point that I've made, I think, in one form or another over the course of several programmes, that it to assemble such a huge force, now to including an American aircraft carrier and its accompanying escorts to the Caribbean, to deploy 16,000 troops in total, and then do nothing to challenge the government in Venezuela that this force is clearly targeting. Well, for me, that beggars belief. It would expose the president to potential ridicule if that happened. And even if this is an elaborate game of bluff, a poker game to try to get President Maduro to step down, in the event that President Maduro does not step down, it is difficult to imagine that this force that has been deployed will go away unused. So maybe the president is having second doubts. His Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, made comments about how the time of regime change was over. I think this was a message to the president to desist from an attack on Venezuela. It may be a sign of dissonance, of disagreement and dispute within his administration. But I think one way or the other, the president is now so deeply committed to an apparent course of action that I think it is going to be almost impossible for him to pull back, even if he is now starting to have doubts, about which, by the way, I am not even sure. On that point, I understand that political opinion or public opinion in the United States is increasingly moving against a military intervention in Venezuela. And there are all sorts of potential problems to a military intervention in Venezuela, which I've discussed in previous programs and which we've talked about on the Duran. This is an enormous country, a very complex geography with many mountains and jungles, a well-armed population, some of whom quite plausibly will oppose an American intervention. Far from clear that whatever government the United States imposes on the country will have legitimacy and will be able to extend its authority. And there may be long-term problems of control, even if the initial operation is successful. Just saying. So there are all sorts of reasons and factors why, in theory, it might be wise to draw back. But somehow, by this point, I cannot imagine it happening. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say about Venezuela in this program. President Trump did talk a lot about relations with China and about relations with Russia. He spoke about both Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin being tough and clever leaders and formidable operators. He appeared, for the moment at least, to rule out deployment of Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine, though he was careful to leave the possibility open. He still spoke wistfully, somewhat wistfully, about the enormous economic benefits of a better relationship with Russia, of a proper economic and trading relationship with Russia, and seemed to blame the Russians for the fact that such a relationship had not yet been established, which, by the way, is completely at odds with modern history. The Russians have been trying to sort out a good economic relationship with the United States going all the way back to the 1960s, and especially, incidentally, in the 1970s. There was, at that time, serious discussion about the United States granting the Soviet Union, as it then was, most favoured nation status. There was a plan, which I very well remember, to build Lockheed TriStars in the Ilyushin factory in Voronezh. There were all sorts of other projects at that time that were being discussed, economic projects, and of course that never materialised, and we got the Jackson-Vanik Amendment instead, which tied economic cooperation with Russia, improvement of economic relations with Russia, to the topic of Jewish emigration from the Soviet Union to Israel. And then, well, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, as we all know, there was a very unhappy period of American interconnections, economic interconnections with Russia in the 1990s, a period which Russians will never forget, though far too many Americans have. And then there was, under Barack Obama, a brief moment when it did appear that economic relations between Russia and the United States would finally get back on track, when the Jackson-Vanik Amendment was finally repealed, when the United States did grant Russia most favoured nation status, and then almost immediately sanctions began. First the Magnitsky Act, and then with the crisis in Ukraine, which began a few years later, just I think a year later in 2014, the procession of sanctions which the United States has enacted, which has left Russia the United States' most sanctioned country. For an American president to imply that it is somehow the Russians who've spurned the opportunities of a good trading and economic relationship with Russia, in the light of this modern history, which again, President Trump seems completely oblivious to, does seem to me remarkable, but it is very consistent with the personality of this particular president. On the topic of the conflict in Ukraine, he again spoke about leaving the Ukrainians and the Russians to fight it out between them and to basically wait until they either exhaust themselves or one or the other stands forth as the winner, which, again, implies that the United States is an entirely detached bystander to this conflict, which, of course, is absurd, given the extent of American involvement in Ukraine, given the fact that it was the United States which floated the idea back in 2008 of Ukraine joining NATO, and got the European states at the NATO summit in Bucharest in 2008 to basically extend a kind of invitation to Ukraine to start to pursue that path. And given all that has happened since, up to and including the enormous numbers of weapons and financial support that the United States has extended to Ukraine over the course of the ensuing years, the US support for the Maidan coup, the US support and indeed instigation, as I well remember, of Ukraine's anti-terrorist operation in eastern Ukraine against Donbass in the summer of 2014. US complicity, if you can want to use that word, in the sabotage of the 2015 Minsk agreement. US hostility to the Nord Stream pipelines, which the German government, and by the way, the American government, are now saying that Ukraine was responsible for destroying. And of course, US support, which continues during the period of the special military operation. As I said, Donald Trump has a habit of wanting to give the impression that the United States is somehow at one great remove from this conflict, which, as I said, the recent history, even a cursory knowledge of Eastern recent history, shows is absurd. All the more absurd, given that he was president during the period in his first term when American arms supplies to Ukraine began openly, and when the United States massively expanded sanctions against Russia in connection with the conflict in Ukraine. Anyway, that's what the president had to say about the conflict in Ukraine. No tomahawks for the moment. As I say, he continues to pretend that the United States is detached and uninvolved in the conflict, that he still wants to broker or mediate some kind of peace. But again, his explanations, his explanation of the recent history is shaky, to say the least. And, well, on China, again, he seemed to speak about a relationship which might turn out eventually for the best. But all the recent moves taken by the United States, again, seem to point firmly in the opposite direction. He did avoid making commitments to defend Taiwan, for which perhaps one should be grateful. His predecessor, Joe Biden, did so on repeated occasions, implying that there is a military alliance between the United States and Taiwan, which, if it exists, which it probably does, by the way, has never been made public. Just saying. But anyway, President Trump at least did avoid talking in that highly provocative way, which would have antagonized the Chinese. The United States is now talking increasingly about using the year between now and the time when the agreements that were reached between the United States and China over the course of the summit meeting between Xi Jinping and Trump in South Korea, which I've discussed extensively, using that time to end US dependence on China for rare earths. And again, over the course of this interview, President Trump seemed to think that this could be done. Well, I am not an expert in rare earth technology, but I doubt, in fact, I am sure that it cannot be done in the space of a year. It would mean the United States getting on top of the science, developing the technology, and not just developing the technology, but establishing the entire industrial process to refine rare earths. And no doubt, if the United States were to focus single-mindedly on achieving this, it would do so after a certain point in time. And I'm not going to speculate in this program as to how long that would be, but I think it is almost inconceivable. It is, in fact, inconceivable that this could be done in the space of a single year. No one whom I have consulted about this, and no open source that I have read, believes that this can be achieved in 1 year. Several years at least would be needed, perhaps more than that. One point I would make about this is that several people, including the US Secretary of the Treasury, Scott Bessent, I believe have spoken about, have compared the plan, of which, by the way, I've seen no sign. There are some bits of what might be described as a plan. The United States has signed various agreements with various countries, Australia, Cambodia, Malaysia, Canada, to develop rare earths. But for the moment, at least, all of this is in its infancy. And none of these countries seems to have a mining and processing and refining industry that comes anywhere close to approximating to what the Chinese have achieved. Even Japan, the one American ally that is furthest on this path, has a very long way to go before it achieves full independence from the Chinese in this area. Anyway, the president and some of his other officials, like perhaps Scott Bessent, have been talking about this, and they have been saying that this is going to be Operation Warp Speed 2. Now, I find that, and I have to say this, a singularly unlucky precedent. Because, of course, Operation Warp Speed 1 was the operation that took place during the period of the pandemic to develop vaccines in order to combat the infection that was prevalent during the pandemic. And yes, it is correct that certain vaccines did appear, but this has been a very controversial story, to say the least. And I noticed that some of these vaccines have now been withdrawn, and there are massive question marks about them. So it seems to me that many might take the view that Operation Warp Speed 1 was far from a success, and given how massively controversial what Operation Warp Speed 1 continues to be, I wonder why people would now, in connection with rare earths, be talking about Operation Warp Speed 2. Just say, perhaps a fairer parallel would be with the Manhattan Project that was launched by the United States during the Second World War. But of course, that took several years, not just one, to achieve fruition. Anyway, it was an interesting interview insofar as it went. I noticed that the president seemed rather more polite about Putin in particular than he has been recently. But overall, it didn't take us very far. And on Venezuela, I have to say, his ambiguities, hardly concealed, as far as I'm concerned, the very high likely prospect of a US military intervention in that country, a US military attack on that country, and in terms of deployment of Tomahawk missiles in Ukraine. Yes, I do believe that for the moment at least, this idea has been put on hold, despite claims that a department of the Pentagon has said that it has no problem with doing this. But it's important to say that there is some controversy on the part of some defense commentators in the United States about the significance of that widely reported decision. But anyway, the president continues to keep that idea, the idea of deploying Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine, on hold. But even there, as I said, he was careful to leave the door to doing that ajar. And I think the Russians ultimately are going to be deeply unimpressed by all that he has said. So there it is, an interview by Donald Trump. Even as Trump himself is giving these interviews, the Chinese and the Russians are deepening their consultations. The Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin is now in China. He arrived in the Chinese city of Hangzhou, where he's already had a meeting, an informal meeting with the Chinese Prime Minister Li Qiang. There's apparently going to be a formal meeting shortly in which delegations, full delegations from Russia and China will participate. And then Mishustin is traveling to Beijing, to China's capital, where he is going to have a meeting, so we're told, with Xi Jinping himself. And if you go to the Russian media especially, but also to some extent to the Chinese media also, the story there is full of further developing Chinese-Russian economic cooperation. And it is not just Mishustin who is in China at the present time from Russia. Russia's Deputy Prime Minister, Denis Manturov, who is in overall charge of the Russian economy, is also in China. Of course, he is participating in some of the same meetings that Mishustin is involved in. But as Russia's former industry minister, he too will no doubt have various things to say about deepening economic cooperation between China and Russia. And shortly before I started making this program, Rosatom, Russia's nuclear engineering power and engineering conglomerate, it's in fact colossal, has confirmed that China and Russia are going to intensify cooperation on nuclear power engineering. The Russians are going to build nuclear reactors in China. And, well, nobody is talking about this, but I, for one, would not be surprised if the Chinese and the Russians are going to share some of the nuclear technology that goes behind the miniature nuclear reactor that the Russians have just demonstrated in the Burevestnik cruise missile, and of which there is probably a larger version operating inside the Poseidon submarine drone. Now, as I said in my program yesterday, there is speculation that these reactors use liquid metal cooling. and this is becoming the consensus, though of course we don't actually know. But I was reading again in Unheard a lengthy article by the German commentator Wolfgang Munshau, who spoke about how Europe is falling further and further behind the two superpowers, the United States and China, in advanced technology areas. And about that, obviously, I agree. But I would say that I think that it is an error to just speak of Europe falling behind two superpowers, the United States and China, because there is a third superpower, which is, of course, Russia, which is also forging ahead with high technology developments. And again, I do find it strange and frustrating that even a objective and level-headed commentator like Wolfgang Munshau has to ignore really quite remarkable new technological developments that are taking place in Russia. So the Russians have demonstrated advanced capabilities in hypersonic missile technology. In the case of the Tsarkon hypersonic cruise missile, that appears to involve some kind of air-breathing technology, maybe a ramjet or even a scramjet technology. I'm not sure I understand the difference myself, but anyway, suffice to say that no one else possesses technology of that kind. Russia, of course, has the world's only operational strategic hypersonic glide vehicle. China is likely to possess one very soon and has already tested one and uses hypersonic glide vehicles on some of its tactical missiles. But this is the only strategic one that is actually in service that I know about. Production of these sort of missiles applies very advanced chemical and material industries to create the shielding and the structures and the propellants of these missiles. The Oreshnik system also seems to have or to involve various very advanced innovations, technological innovations as well. And, well, we now have demonstrated prowess, technological prowess, on the part of the Russians in the field of miniaturized nuclear reactors, which, as far as I can see, is not duplicated anywhere else. Now, there's been much discussion about AI technology, and by the way, Russia most definitely does have an AI program. And as I've said in many programs, it has a plan with which it is moving forward to develop the very highest end chips as well, just to say. But everywhere that I have read, people say that the chips, the programs in AI are important, but power generation is at least as important in achieving an AI revolution. And surely a miniaturized, the ability to develop and produce miniaturized nuclear reactors is an important step in that direction too. But as I said, nobody seems to make these connections. Well, I am not claiming that Russia is ahead of the United States or China in science and technology. That would be a far-fetched and indeed ridiculous claim. but it is certainly proficient in certain areas. Contrast that with the situation in Europe, where Wolfgang Munchau talks about technological stagnation. Clearly, that is not the case in Russia. And I mention this not so much in order to talk up what the Russians are doing, but to again draw attention to the fact that Europe is indeed falling further and further behind in the technological race. Anyway, there we go. That's the programme. That's what the President of the United States has been saying. That is what is going on between the Russians and the Chinese at the present time. There is definitely technological cooperation between the two. The Russians apparently are planning to start exporting aircraft engines, where, by the way, they also seem to be in the process of making significant industrial breakthroughs to China. And, well, an awful lot is taking place there, in marked contrast to what we see in some places in the West. But it is the conflict in Ukraine that continues ultimately to shape the picture. And, well, I will begin by returning to the topic of the helicopter raids carried out by the Ukrainian special forces in the area of Pokrovsk, where the Russians have a large body of Ukrainian troops. There are arguments about how large it is, but it certainly seems to number at least in the thousands. Anyway, where the Russians have a large body of Ukrainian troops encircled. Now, yesterday, I devoted a large part of my programme to discussing these helicopter raids carried out by the GUR, Ukrainian military intelligence, and apparently supervised by the actual head of military intelligence, Ukrainian military intelligence, Kirill Budanov. And, well, Larry Johnson on Sonar 21 has provided some further details. It does indeed seem as if three helicopters were involved. There were apparently two operations. The first one is the one that I have seen the videos of. Both the videos provided by the Ukrainians of the helicopter landing and the video provided by the Russians of the Russian drones killing all of the Ukrainian commandos who exited the helicopter, all 11 of them, as they tried to carry out whatever was the mission they had been assigned to do. So that was one operation. There was apparently a follow-up operation on the following day, also involving Black Hawk helicopters, two on this occasion. And it seems that between 20 and 25 Ukrainian commandos were deployed on this occasion. And it seems that the Russians, again, were tracking the entire operation, hunted down the Ukrainian commandos with their drones, and again, killed them all. So three helicopters used in total, and perhaps 30 and 40 Ukrainian commandos, highly trained, expensively trained men, their lives thrown away in this really very strange and very bizarre operation. Now, it's important to say that Larry Johnson is a former US intelligence officer. He has worked in both the CIA and, from my knowledge, in the State Department. He has had some contacts. He's had, in fact, I believe, quite extensive contacts with US special forces. And that makes him, as far as I'm concerned, perhaps the most authoritative person to make a comment about this operation that the Ukrainians tried to carry out in the area of Pokrovsk. And I was interested to see that he too believes that this was an extraction operation of some kind. In other words, it was not an attempt by Ukraine to reverse the military situation in Pokrovsk. 11 men, or 24 men, or 36 men, or 40 men, however many it was, would not be able to do this. That idea is indeed preposterous. It's unlikely to have been a sabotage operation. If it was, why try and do it on two consecutive nights when the first group has been killed over the course of the first night? And would Budanov himself participate so directly in a mere sabotage operation? And would Ukraine risk its expensive Black Hawk helicopters, which must be in short supply, on a sabotage operation of that kind? I don't think so. And no, nor does Larry Johnson. Like me, he believes that it was an extraction operation, that the Ukrainians tried to insert troops into Pokrovsk, or close to Pokrovsk, in order to get someone, obviously someone important, out. Now, Larry Johnson makes some, I think, very well-informed speculations about who it was that the Ukrainians were trying to extract. I'm not going to discuss this part of Larry Johnson's article. I would simply say go to Sonar 21 and you can read what he has to say. The article is Ukraine Suicide Helicopter Missions, Why? And you will find his own detailed analysis of this operation and what he believes the Ukrainians were trying to achieve and who it was that they were almost certainly trying to extract. Whatever the intention, however, it clearly failed. Now, there is on this topic a very interesting piece which appeared yesterday on TASS, the official Russian news agency. And it reports comments made by the Russian Defense Ministry, and it reports them as follows. And notice that this report, which you can also find, of course, on the Russian Defense Ministry's website, was considered so important by someone in Moscow that they decided to give it further publicity by publishing it in Russia's official news agency, TASS, which means that it will get a global circulation and will be read by many people in the media around the world. Anyway, the Russian Defense Ministry said this: an attempt by militants of the Ukrainian Armed Forces 425th Assault Regiment Skala to break through in an armored combat vehicle towards the settlement of Gryshino in the Donetsk People's Republic has been thwarted. All militants were eliminated. And, well, Skala, as those who've been following the war closely, is indeed very much of an elite unit in Ukraine. In fact, it's been involved in various operations. There's been some criticism of it in Ukraine itself. It is not an entirely uncontroversial outfit, just to say. But the thing that struck me about this particular comment is that it suggests that Scala, the people involved in Scala, the 425th Assault Regiment, were trying to break out of Pokrovsk and escape to the village of Gryshino, northwest of Pokrovsk, which the Ukrainians still control. An attempt by militants of the Ukrainian Armed Forces, 425th Assault Regiment Scala, to break through in an armoured combat vehicle towards the settlement of Gryshino has been thwarted. All militants were eliminated. So, it seems to me, I mean, I wonder whether this is connected with this helicopter mission, whether there wasn't someone in that armoured vehicle that the people, the Scala people, within Pokrovsk were trying to extract. Of course, they were trying to escape themselves in this armoured vehicle. But perhaps they had someone with them in that armoured vehicle. And I wonder whether this special forces operation with the helicopters was intended to meet up with this armoured vehicle and to get these Scala people and whoever else they might have had with them out of Pokrovsk. It is a little strange that TASS and the Russian Defence Ministry are giving so much emphasis to this event. And by the way, it implies, the reporting of it implies, that just as all of the Scala soldiers, commandos, in the armoured vehicle were, as the Russian Defence Ministry says, eliminated, so if there was anyone else in the armoured vehicle, they presumably were eliminated also. Anyway, it's a strange business, and there are still many unanswered questions about this affair. One of them, by the way, for me, is why the Russians didn't also, since they obviously knew about this operation and were ready for it, why they didn't also destroy the helicopters. Might it be, again, because Americans were operating them? Just saying. And someone in Moscow took the decision that they didn't want Americans killed. Just saying. Or perhaps there's some other reason that I don't know. As there's lots of unanswered questions. And for the record, the Ukrainian side of the internet is full of speculation that the Russians were indeed tipped off in advance that this operation was going to be attempted and that there are moles or infiltrators, Russian infiltrators or spies, if you prefer, who have managed to weave their way in, worm their way in to Ukrainian military intelligence, which no longer has watertight control over its secrets. Anyway, we will one day, sometime in the future, learn the truth about this strange affair. In the meantime, it remains the case that the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk continue to be surrounded. Now, as I said yesterday, the Russians, or at least Russian reporting channels, are confirming that 80% of the town of Pokrovsk itself is now under Russian control. And over the last couple of hours, further footage has appeared, which appears to show other areas of Pokrovsk beyond that 80% also coming under Russian control. Also, there's also been rumours and speculations on the Russian part of the internet for several days that the Russians are advancing from Pokrovsk, or at least some Russian forces are advancing from Pokrovsk towards the village of Gryshino itself. This being the key village used by the Ukrainians as their base area in order to launch attacks from the west to try to break through to the Ukrainian troops who are currently trapped in Pokrovsk. Gryshino, located just north of the main supply road, the one which, by the way, the Russians have already cut, is a key Ukrainian position in the Pokrovsk area. In some ways, it's the most important Ukrainian position just outside the territory of the Russian trap, which remains under Ukrainian control. And going back to the helicopter incident, the landing area of the helicopters is in fact located not that far to the east of the village of Gryshino itself. Anyway, the Ukrainians have now released maps, DS and the others have now released maps, which show an expanse of what's called the grey zone, in other words, contested territory, along a road from Pokrovsk right up to the boundaries of Gryshino itself. Now, that all but confirms that the Russians have actually reached the boundary of Gryshino. Now, in order for them to have done that, they will have had to advance through various fortified positions, which they have presumably captured. This advance appears to have happened along a road, but it seems that Ukrainian defences along this road were patchy. Gryshino itself is a large village, it's a big village, which is why it has been possible for the Ukrainians to use it as a base area for attacks towards Pokrovsk. There are various bodies of water, lakes and things, located around Gryshino. It is a relatively defendable place. It's not clear whether the Russians intend to storm it for the moment. Well, we will just have to wait and see. But it is nonetheless interesting that the Russians are now clearly involved in a battle in and around Gryshino. And the Russian Defense Ministry, just to say, just before I started making this program, published this report. It said four attempts to release the encircled Ukrainian group in Pokrovsk by mercenaries of the so-called International League of the Territorial Defense of Ukraine and the 32nd Mechanized Brigade of the Ukrainian Army from Gryshino were thwarted. The enemy lost over 50 men. So it looks as if some kind of battle around Gryshino is now underway. But of course, further to the east, the circle, the siege of Pokrovsk itself continues. The Russians are also claiming that they are making more progress in clearing Mirnograd of the Ukrainians. And again, this is what the Russian Defense Ministry has said about that battle. Units of the 5th Motorized Rifle Brigade of the 51st Army of the Russian Armed Forces mopped up 24 buildings in the northern, eastern and southeastern parts of Mirnograd. Russian troops continue to expand the control area and tighten the encirclement of the enemy's groups of troops from the east. So again, what the Russian Defense Ministry are telling us is that the cauldron in which the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd is located is getting smaller and smaller, and that the Russians are pushing forward ever more quickly. Now, notice that the Defense Ministry says the 24 buildings in northern, eastern and southern parts of Mirnograd have been captured. It would be interesting to know what sort of buildings these were. Mirnograd is a relatively modern development built mostly by the Soviet Union to operate the Dmitrov mine, which is located in that area, but also as part of the industries that used to exist in the area of Pokrovsk. And there are apparently quite a lot of high-rise buildings in Mirnograd. If some of these 24 buildings that the Russians have captured are indeed high-rise buildings, then, well, these are natural fortresses. But if the Russians are capturing them at the rate of 24 a day, maybe not all of the buildings, the 24 buildings were high-rise buildings. Some of them might have been cottages, for all we know. But, well, anyway, 24 buildings in a day does look like a fairly rapid advance to me, given the topography of the area and the kind of buildings, residential buildings, in this part of the world that we are talking about. It is increasingly looking like the implosion of the cauldron itself. Now, the Ukrainians have not yet given up. Sirsky himself is in the area. There are many reports now circulating on the Ukrainian internet that the Battle of Pokrovsk is for him a career-breaking battle. If Pokrovsk is lost, then the demands for his removal will become so strong, it has been suggested that even Zelensky himself might struggle to keep him in post, in which case, as I discussed in my programme yesterday, the demand apparently will come to impose, to appoint General Drapaty, closely connected though he is to the various ultra-nationalist brigades in Ukraine, but to appoint Drapaty to take his place. So Sirsky is pulling out all of the stops to save his job and perhaps incidentally to save the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk, and he's continuing to throw whatever he can into the battle in order to do that. And there are lots of reports about continuing difficult encounter battles in the area of the Russian breakthrough northeast of Pokrovsk, and specifically in Rodinska. Now, a couple of days ago, the Russian newspaper Redovka said that the pendulum in this area had swung back in favour of the Russians. The Ukrainian attacks had been repelled and the Russians had regained much of the territory, including Kucherov Yar, that the Ukrainians claimed to have captured. A report from one of the Russian reporting channels has said that the pendulum has swung back again, and that the Ukrainians now are once again on the attack, and that there is fighting going on in northern Rodinska. But there are also reports that the Russians are sending further reinforcements to this area to counter these Ukrainian attacks. This has been a constant story going all the way back to August. Zelensky, almost obsessively, has been trying to roll the Russians back in this area of the Russian breakthrough of August 2025. And, well, he now has a rationalization for it. He wants to recapture Rodinska, presumably to provide an exit corridor for the Ukrainian troops trapped in Pokrovsk, or perhaps in his own mind and Zelensky's mind, a supply corridor to the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk so that they can continue to hold their positions there. To me, all of this looks very unreal. The Ukrainians have made many counterattacks in these precisely same area since the start of the Pokrovsk operation in August. None of them have achieved the outcome that the Ukrainians wanted. The Ukrainians have conducted many counterattacks in many places over the course of this year. All of these have been local counterattacks. I remember, for example, back in the winter, there was lots of claims about successful Ukrainian counterattacks southwest of Pokrovsk in the area of the village of Kotlino and in the village of Udachny, now both firmly under Russian control. And there were all sorts of optimistic claims, optimistic that is from a Ukrainian perspective, that these two villages had been recaptured or were in the process of being recaptured by the Ukrainians, and that the Russian forces in this area were on the brink of being surrounded by the Ukrainians. There was an awful lot of that. But all of these attacks have been unsuccessful. And they have, in fact, all that they have done is that they have added to the total of Ukrainian losses without achieving any practical effect. And I strongly suspect, in fact, I am absolutely sure that these latest Ukrainian attacks in the Rodinska, Kucherov Yar, Vladimirovka area northeast of Pokrovsk are in the end going to prove no different. Putin recently in their meeting told the Russian generals, Gerasimov and the others, to make sure that all Ukrainian counterattacks in the Pokrovsk area were repelled, and whatever numbers of men the Russians will need to deploy in order to parry these counterattacks, they will deploy. And given that they now convincingly outnumber the Ukrainians on the battlefields, I believe that precisely these sort of deployments, these reinforcements, will be sent. And as I said, whatever brief gains the Ukrainians make will be ephemeral. Now, both in Pokrovsk and in Kupiansk, where the Ukrainians find themselves in a cauldron as well, on the east bank of the Oskol River, the conditions in which they are now in must be terrible. We are now well into the autumn, October. The temperatures are falling. It's the deep period of the Rasputitsa, both in this area in Pokrovsk, much of which is open fields. The fields will be basically mud, making it, by the way, all but impossible, I would have thought, for any fleeing Ukrainian troops to try to escape the encirclement across the fields. The mud in this area, as we discussed on the Duran in a program that we have done with him, with Stanislav Krapivnik. The mud in this area is incredibly heavy. And I mean, it congeals and it pulls off boots and it stops men. It's very, very difficult to walk across, even in calm conditions. And of course, the conditions of any escape will not be calm. And bear in mind, they will anyway have to take place at night, at a time when there is little visibility because of the heavy clouds. And of course, with the Russian drones buzzing constantly overhead with their thermal images and other night vision devices. So this is a horrific situation. And I understand that it is pouring rain as well. And the cold, the rain, the mud, the lack of supplies, probably the lack of heating. I just shudder to think what the conditions that these soldiers are going through in Pokrovsk and Kupiansk must be like. In Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, the Ukrainians continue to show some resistance. But as I said, if they've lost 24 buildings in Mirnograd in one day, it suggests perhaps the beginning of a collapse. And if so, that would not surprise me. And, well, in Kupiansk, the Russians have allegedly crossed the Oskol River and are now fighting in the area inside the former cauldron in eastern Kupiansk. And conditions there appear to be very bad also. In fact, they appear to be even worse, if anything, than they are in Pokrovsk. Now, saying all of this, Zelensky himself has made some claims. He says that there's been a successful Ukrainian counterattack in the Kupiansk area. He says that a Ukrainian force attacking from the west has broken through all the way to the west bank of the Oskol River. I've not seen any Russian accounts about this, though I believe there are some. The reports that I have seen, which do not come from the Russians, do suggest that some kind of counterattack did get through, did take place. And as so often happens, what the Russians did is that they stepped aside, let the assault force advance deep inside Russian-controlled territory, and then they closed in around it. And this assault force apparently is trapped some distance, by the way, from the west bank of the Oskol River. Again, this looks like a deeply misguided counterattack if the reports about it are true. And one again wonders about the rationality behind these kind of actions. Anyway, elsewhere, Denis Pushilin, the head of the Donetsk regional government, says that the Russians are now close to the capture of Siversk, and that the situation there is going very much in Russia's favour. There's been much fighting. There is fighting continuing in Liman and in the area around Liman. The Ukrainians claimed they have conducted a counterattack in Yampol. Pushilin has said that the Ukrainians did deploy more men to try to hold Yampol, which could be a sign that there was a Ukrainian counterattack, but Pushilin went on to say that he's confident that the Russians will indeed soon capture Yampol, the entirety of Yampol, which is likely to be true as well. Anyway, as a number of people have pointed out to me in various threads and in email messages, the Ukrainians did launch an attack a couple of days ago on a dam inside Russia in Belgorod region. As a number of people have pointed out to me in various emails and threads, there has also been, over the last couple of days, some kind of Ukrainian attack on a dam in Belgorod region, which did do some damage to the dam and did result in flooding, which may have interfered with Russian logistics to some extent and slowed the Russian advance in this area of Liman and and Siversk and in Kharkov region. Anyway, the effect, however, of this attack on this dam, which, by the way, is located inside Russia in Belgorod region, well, the effect of that attack is that it appears now to have created further flooding downstream, which appears to be affecting Ukrainian logistics as well, including generally in the Liman area. Altogether, it seems to me that the Ukrainians continue this profligate and pointless practice of conducting counterattacks, whose only effect ultimately is to thin their own forces, even as the Russian forces continue to strengthen and advance across the battlefronts. There was reports a couple of days ago that south of the city of Zaporozhye, in the village, the big village of Primorske, which is located on the east bank of the Dnieper River, the Ukrainians conducted a counterattack there and briefly recovered some ground. But the video footage within about a day showed the Russians back in secure control. These counterattacks may buy Sirsky a little time with Zelensky. He may be able to tell Zelensky, look, we're on the attack again. We're attacking the Russians in Rodinska. We're attacking the Russians on the west bank of the Oskol River. We've retaken parts of Yampol. We've retaken parts of Primorske. But the overall effect, in the end, is to weaken the Ukrainians, not to strengthen them. Now, I used to say that months ago, years ago, at an earlier stage in the special military operation. But it is becoming now a more widely expressed talking point. Even the Western media, like that article in The Spectator that I discussed yesterday, seems to be conceding this, that this constant aggressiveness, this urge to go on the attack all the time, that Zelensky is pushing his commanders to do, all it is doing is weakening the Ukrainians to the point where it makes further Russian advances ultimately easier as well. Anyway, we shall see how long things play out. The Battle of Pokrovsk and of Kupiansk continues. And I would again repeat a key point about both of these battles, which is that this time, in contrast to their usual practice, the Russians have not allowed the Ukrainians lines of retreat. They seem intent on destroying the Ukrainian garrisons in Pokrovsk and Kupiansk completely, something that they did not do in Bakhmut, Lysychansk, Avdeyevka, or Ugledar. This time, however, it's different. Anyway, now, I ought to say that over the course of last night, the Russians conducted another major missile and drone strike against Ukraine. Somebody did an analysis recently and they determined that Russia had used more missiles in October than they have at any point in the war up to now, 270 in total, which, by the way, is well above the number that the Russians used to launch, as I remember, back in 2022, when they first began their missile offensive against Ukraine. At that time, the Russians would launch roughly 100 missiles over the course of a month, and they would do that usually over a period of 1 or 2 days in the month. Whereas now, they're conducting attacks continuously, day after day, night after night. And the missiles changed in the original strikes back in 2022, in the autumn of 2022. It was KH-101s, Calibres, and the odd KH-32. The Russians still launched these enormous KH-32 anti-ship missiles against Ukraine as well, though we hear less about them, but they've done so again recently against particular heavy targets that they are seeking to destroy. But interestingly, the pattern of Russian missile strikes has changed. Today, the Russians use mostly ballistic missiles like the Iskanders, which are ground launched, and they are using more and more Kinjal missiles all the time. Kinjal hypersonic missiles launched by the MiG-31, very fast supersonic fighter jets. And Zelensky has said that Ukraine has just received two more Patriot missile systems. I believe it is from Germany. These are refurbished Patriot missile systems, and apparently they are of an older generation than the Patriot missile systems that the United States used to supply. They're more focused on shooting down aircraft than missiles, and especially not ballistic missiles. Well, it all anyway seems entirely pointless, given that the Ukrainians themselves have recently admitted that the effectiveness of the Patriot missiles, the PAC-3 super advanced American supplied Patriot missiles, has fallen from a claimed 42% earlier in the war, a claim, by the way, which I think is overstated, to just 6% now. So again, Ukraine receiving very expensive missiles and missile systems from Germany and from the West, which are in desperately short supply, and which, according to the Ukrainians themselves, are only 6% effective. The logic escapes me. It makes no obvious sense to me at all. For the record, it seems that the Ukrainian Patriot missile battery that was previously protecting the central area of Kiev at the, I believe it was Yubileyniy airport, that it has been withdrawn from that airport. Apparently it has been attacked and damaged so many times by Russian missiles, hypersonic missiles. And, well, there are reports that a key Ukrainian commander operating these missiles has been killed, that the Ukrainians have reluctantly been forced to pull that missile battery away, which presumably means that Kiev itself is now Well, essentially defenseless against missile strikes. The war in the air is going disastrously. The war on the ground is going disastrously. In the economic war, Ukraine is failing as well. A Ukrainian economist I saw has just given an interview in which he said that Ukraine's budget deficit this year is going to be around 20% of GDP. Ukraine's debt to GDP ratio is over 100%. All in themselves very, very bad indicators. But he said that Ukraine is only able to account to cover a fraction of its spending. It has to depend heavily on external assistance. More than half of Ukrainian spending depends now on transfers, financial transfers from the West, which for the moment at least means mostly from Europe. And that is drying up. Apparently, the Belgian government is now tottering, partly because there's a budget crisis in Belgium, and there is apparently growing dissension about Belgium's continued financial assistance to Ukraine. I'm not fully familiar with this story. Belgium, of course, has held out against European proposals, European Commission proposals, to provide Ukraine with a 140 billion euro loan drawn on the frozen Russian assets. A deeply dubious and illegal operation from every conceivable point of view. We will see whether that goes ahead. But even if it does, it's just a stopgap, given the exploding cost of the war for Ukraine itself, which I discussed in my program yesterday, with the Ukrainian budget spiraling out of control as Ukraine's war comes ever closer to being lost. One does wonder whether some of the people in the media in the West who continue to advocate more and more financial transfers to Ukraine, supposedly in order to keep Ukraine in the battle, understand or want to hear the truth that what they're really doing is making a select group of very corrupt and very rich Ukrainians even richer than they previously were. And that is all in practical terms, in terms of the outcome of the war that they are doing. It does seem an extraordinary misuse of European taxpayers' money. And by the way, it is also an extraordinary thing to insist on doing, using someone else's money. In other words, the Russian frozen assets, which don't even belong to the Europeans, and which quite plausibly, legally, they could find themselves on the hook for. But nothing apparently changes. The obsession continues to support Ukraine in every way possible. There are now reports and rumors that there's going to be some kind of secret meeting of European leaders in Madrid to discuss the European situation. How a meeting can be secret when it is being talked about by everyone, as far as I can see, everyone who's interested in this conflict, I really don't understand. And one wonders why this meeting has to be secret anyway. What exactly is going to be discussed which justifies making this meeting secret? Could it be that what will make it secret, or the purpose of making it secret, is to keep the story of it out of the European media so that European taxpayers, European citizens, aren't aware that the European leaderships, the governments of the key European countries, continue to throw more and more of their money into this black hole, which is the conflict in Ukraine. Anyway, there it is. Of actual moves to try to bring the war to an end, of diplomacy, there is not the slightest hint. The Russians have given up on it. The Russians see no interest to make further initiatives of their own. After all, they're winning the war, and they probably calculate that before very long, the whole of Donbass will have fallen under their control. Why would they negotiate or make offers now beyond those which they have already done? They've set out their position last year in Putin's speech to the Russian Foreign Ministry of the 14th of June 2024. They've set out their position in meetings with the Ukrainians in Istanbul. They came to what they thought was a tentative agreement with President Trump in Alaska. They've no reason to go beyond any of that. President Trump himself gave no inkling at all over the course of his 60 Minutes interview that he had the slightest idea for any further initiative, any further diplomatic initiative to bring the war to an end. And the European leaders incomprehensibly continue to do everything they possibly can to prolong a war that they are losing, with outcomes for Europe and perhaps even for themselves that will, as a result, be even more catastrophic than they would be if the war were to be brought to an end now. Well, there it is. The situation in Ukraine continues to deteriorate, and there is word that, as I discussed in my program yesterday, that the Western economies, the economies of the United States, and by the way of Europe too, are on brink of recession. I have been of the view that in Britain we are at the very least in a recession situation for the last year and a half, living standards falling, economic activity quietly declining, without it being yet perhaps a recession that fully appears in the statistics. But I was out and about in London over the weekend, and my sense is that things are suddenly, sharply turning very much worse. I may be wrong. These are just impressions. Who knows? And anyway, I'm hearing the same about the United States also. There is a major recession in the West next year, perhaps as early as the winter. Well, the failure to end the war in Ukraine before this big recession gets underway is going to aggravate the sense of crisis in Ukraine itself, as dwindling Western aid inevitably dwindles further still. But of course, there's also going to be inevitably a feedback loop, because the crisis that will then start to play out in Ukraine is going to feed back in sentiment, especially in Europe, and is quite likely to deepen the sense of gloom and uncertainty that you are increasingly seeing here in Europe as well. Altogether, this is a dismal situation, a dismal situation from every conceivable point of view. The fact that the Russians are now intent on surrounding and trapping and destroying entire Ukrainian brigades, to my mind, says more about the change in the direction of the war than almost anything else, apart perhaps from the fact that the Ukrainians have failed to conduct an offensive of their own this year. A major change is taking place in the war. I think that some people in the West are starting to feel and sense it, but it's not yet critical enough to cause policy to change. And I suspect that when the crisis really hits home, by then it will be too late. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Be more from me soon. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can also support our work by going to Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Please remember also to look up our new Substack page. And last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.